This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
This is NBC Nightly News, Friday, September 1st.
Good evening. We'll have more on the developments in the Watergate bugging case. We'll hear George McGovern talking about tightening up his campaign organization, and we'll have a look at the new unemployment figures. And first, Bobby Fischer.
Today, in 1972, nobody was bigger news than chess master Bobby Fischer. He squared off against Russian Boris Spassky in a historic match seen as a showdown of the Cold War. Fischer's life as an extraordinary chess genius and troubled soul is the subject of a new documentary, directed by my guest Liz Garbus, called Bobby Fischer Against the World. It premieres Monday on HBO. The film chronicles Fischer's unusual family life, his rise to celebrity as a chess master, and his increasingly bizarre behavior after his 1972 match with Spassky. Fischer eventually became an angry, paranoid anti-Semite who fled the U.S. to avoid criminal prosecution. The film includes interviews with many who knew Fischer, including chess master and physician Anthony Sadie, who also joined our interview. Liz Garbus has directed more than a dozen documentaries, including her Oscar-nominated film about a Louisiana prison called The Farm, Angola, USA. Bobby Fischer Against the World features a lot of archival footage of Fischer. You can hear his awkwardness in this interview, conducted in his late 20s when he was in his chess-playing prime.
Bobby, you've given virtually your entire life to the world of chess. What about Bobby Fischer the man? What's he like?
I don't know, it's pretty, chess and me, you know, it's like, it's hard to take them apart, you know. Chess like my alter ego, you know, I don't need to, you know, it's...
But there are times when you get away from that chessboard. What do you do?
I don't do too much at the most. See, I'm really, you know, tied up in chess. I intend to expand, but first I gotta get the title. That's basically...
I asked Liz Garbus and Anthony Sadie about Fischer's early years, growing up in New York with his mother, Regina. Well, Liz Garbus, Anthony Sadie, welcome to Fresh Air. We know that Regina, Bobby Fischer's mom, was deeply involved in left-wing activity and was monitored by the FBI. Liz Garbus, do you know what kind of impact this had on the kids growing up?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of remarkable. We got both Bobby Fischer's and Regina Fischer's FBI file, and Bobby Fischer being someone who was actually ultimately hunted by the U.S., a fugitive, arrested in Japan, his FBI file was, you know, about a eighth of the size of his mother's, Regina Fischer, which just tells you a lot about the period in which they were growing up and the suspicions the FBI had about her communist activities. It was a paranoid time, right? McCarthy, and this was the Cold War, and this is the environment in which they were growing up. So that, you know, one imagines that paranoia would have transferred to the young Bobby. One of our interviewees told a story about how Regina had instructed Bobby, if he was ever sort of sitting on the steps outside of his house, if anybody asked him what his name was or where he lived, he should just say, "I can neither confirm nor deny that." So he was apparently trained at a young age how to kind of watch his back.
Wow. Now, of course, he is a terrific chess player, and at age 13 or 14, he starts beating people who are much, much older and making it clear what a master he could become. I thought we would listen to a clip from the documentary of Bobby Fischer as a teenager. Here he is at age 15. He's appearing on the TV show I've Got a Secret. We're going to hear the voice of Gary Moore, who is the host, and Dick Clark, who was a panelist. Let's listen.
You tell us how old you are and where you're from.
I'm 15. I'm from Brooklyn.
He is 15 years old and he is from Brooklyn.
Yeah!
All right. Will you show your headline to camera 3 and to Dick Clark, because we'll make him go to work on you. It says, "Teenager's strategy defeats all comers."
This strategy, did it involve finances?
No.
Did you have any help?
No.
Did it all by yourself? Did it make people happy?
Made me happy.
This young man's name is Bobby Fischer, and already he is the United States chess champion. He is 15 years old, and he has defeated the Masters. He is the United States champion in chess.
And a piece of Americana there. Bobby Fischer at age 15 on the TV show I've Got a Secret. That's from the documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World, directed by our guest Liz Garbus. Also with us, Anthony Sadie, an international chess master who knew Bobby Fischer. Liz Garbus, did Bobby Fischer's mother, Regina, want him to be a public figure? Is that how he got on TV?
It seems that as the, you know, sort of Bobby's accolades grew and it was clear, his, you know, what his prowess was and his potential on the chessboard, that she did support that rise, that she was deeply ambitious and ambitious for her son. At a certain point, I think that ambition and that drive of hers was probably too much for Bobby, and Bobby had to separate from her and would only go to chess tournaments with his sister, Joan. He had to pull away from perhaps her drive and her ambitions for him.
And she actually moved out of the house when he was 16, is that right?
Yeah, apparently at age 16, Regina moved out of the house, leaving Bobby there to kind of raise himself. People who went over to the house at the time, and I imagine Dr. Sadie was one of them, talked about kind of the total chaos and disarray that he lived in. You know, but then he sort of, I think, quickly, you know, went on tour and was sort of became more of a life of living in hotel rooms and playing chess tournaments.
Anthony Sadie, did you know him to be, in these years when he was a teenager and in his 20s, a difficult person to get along with?
He was difficult, yes, from teenage on. In terms of just everyday agreement on, you know, where do we eat or what hotel should we stay in? There was always an issue, and it had to be his way. He didn't have empathy for other people's desires or needs at all. I guess it was exemplified when he came to my family's home in Long Island prior to the big match, and I said to Bobby, incidentally, my dad is very ill. And Bobby said, oh, I don't mind.
And Bobby, you know, Bobby was hauled up there. I mean, from what I know and from what Dr. Sadie has told us, Dr. Sadie's mother was going to great lengths to keep Bobby Fischer happy and fed and all the great fruit spreads. But, you know, meanwhile, there were sort of greater needs going on in the household.
Now, was he making his living at chess from, you know, his teens on through his 20s?
Bobby would travel around, and Larry Evans, who has now passed away, his father would organize tours for Bobby Fischer. And Bobby would go, and people would pay to play Bobby Fischer. So there were different ways that Bobby made money. There would be people in chess clubs who would just pay to play Bobby Fischer, and he'd play blitz matches against, you know, and then he would make money this way. The purse in chess matches at the time was quite small, and it was difficult for a chess player to make a living playing chess. And this was one of the major things that Bobby actually took on as his cause and really caused a change in the purses, so you could actually make a living as a chess player.
You said he did blitz matches. What are they?
Blitz is a term for a timed game in which each side has only 5 minutes. It's a very action-packed form of chess.
And would he play more than one opponent at a time?
Yeah, there's footage in the film. People always remark on it because it looks to those of us outside the chess world so remarkable. But to people in the chess world, it was quite a normal scene where Bobby would play 20 opponents at once, going from board to board, making a move, while the other people, you know, sometimes four times his age, would still be pondering the move. He would be back after having played 20, you know, 19 other people.
He would rotate around a circle where there are boards of other people, and he would look at the board for 2 seconds, make a move, and just keep moving.
Right.
Right.
So ostensibly keeping all of those patterns in his head, you know, of each board, and that's sort of the state of play.
So let's talk about the historic match between Bobby Fischer and the Russian Boris Spassky. Liz Garbus, why was so much attention paid to this confrontation?
It's hard to imagine that in 1972, all eyes were on a chess match, but it, in fact, seems to be the case. Bobby Fischer was this, you know, self-taught Brooklyn boy who kind of took the New York chess scene and then the national chess scene by storm. And the Russians had been dominating the sport for decades. The Soviet Union had made chess its national sport. It was a way of demonstrating intellectual superiority over the rest of the world, including certainly the U.S. and the West. And so for an American, Bobby Fischer, to have a real chance at beating that machine, this was big stuff. I mean, it was as if, you know, there was going to be a chess match between, or a boxing match between, a representative of the U.S. government and Al-Qaeda. I mean, it was the organizing principle of the time, and here they were going to, you know, have war over the board. So the symbolism of the match was enormous.
A real Cold War confrontation, national prestige on the line. Anthony Sadie, you were in touch with Bobby at the time. It was not easy getting him here. He was living in Los Angeles, right? And what was
in Pasadena, near Los Angeles.
Yeah, what was his state of mind as this approached?
Ambivalence. He wanted to go and win the world championship, but he had many provisos that had to be met. And it was always touch and go whether he would go through with the match. I thought it was an event of great historical importance, and I wanted to see it take place. So I bent every effort to go on the positive side and get him at least from California to New York, where he could be dealt with by many negotiators.
Right. Now, the event itself was going to be in Reykjavik, Iceland. And you said he had a lot of provisos. What were some of his demands to get the match going?
Money was a chief arguing point at the beginning. And, in fact, I don't think he would have gone and played if the British financier James Slater had not doubled the purse overnight and issued a challenge to Fisher, come out and play if you're not a chicken.
And we should add that there had been opportunities for Bobby to make it this far before. Bobby had backed out of matches before, so there certainly was no guarantee that these were just antics or provocations. He really had lived up to his threats before of, you know, if you don't satisfy my conditions, I'm not coming. Bobby was already 29. You know, he probably could have won the championship earlier, but he had really... When people hadn't met his conditions before, he had dropped out. So there was extraordinary pressure on it this time to really get him to go. People knew how serious he was.
Is it true that Henry Kissinger called?
I can personally confirm one call of Kissinger placed to our family home when Fisher was there. That's beyond dispute.
We spoke to Dr. Kissinger for the documentary, and he said, you know, it was important for an American to win this match. So he wanted to call Fisher and tell him to go. He very simply said, you know, this is a matter of national importance. And Bobby Fisher, get out of Dr. Sadie's house and get on a plane and go to Reykjavik. Now, this coincided with the purse being doubled by a financier. And so it was kind of the perfect storm. Finally, Bobby would go.
Now, it's interesting, you know, Anthony Sadie, you said that Bobby was living in Pasadena, California, and you sort of coaxed him to New York. You said, I need to go back. My father's ill. Let's go to New York. And you were really simply trying to get him a step closer to Iceland, right?
Correct.
Right. Now, what happened the first time he went to JFK Airport to go to Reykjavik? Were you there,
Anthony Sadie? He seemed headed for Iceland, and our troubles were over, we thought. But as we were headed toward the check-in desk, a New York Daily News photographer had spied Bobby and started chasing us with about 50 pounds of photographic equipment on his back. And Bobby saw the guy and started running. I turned around and blocked the photographer, and the photographer said, "What are you going to do, stop me?" I said, "Oh, no. In any event, that spooked Bobby. He had this phobia of the press for a long time. And instead of checking in for the flight, he just left the airport.
All right. So eventually he does get to Reykjavik. And there is the appointed day at which Boris Spassky is there. This is going to be televised. The whole world is watching. And I thought we'd listen to a moment from the documentary and get a flavor of this. And this is a bit of a montage from Liz Garbus' documentary. We're going to hear some of the broadcasters who were telecasting it.
The clock has now been started. It was officially 5 o'clock in Reykjavik. Spassky is obviously anxious about the whereabouts of Mr. Fisher.
Bobby was nowhere to be seen. And all of us despaired.
If Fisher doesn't show up, by the time 1 hour has elapsed, he forfeits the game automatically. Oh, there he goes now. He's just played one, pawn to queen four.
You saw Spassky make his move, then he touched his clock, which turns his clock off, but turns his opponent's clock on. So Fisher's time is now ticking.
And that's from the documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World, directed by our guest Liz Garbus, also with us Anthony Sadie, whose voice is in that clip. He is an international chess master who knew Bobby Fischer. So when this confrontation happens, Bobby Fischer doesn't show up on time for the first round. Anthony Sadie, what was going on?
That was a minor blip because he was just late to start the first game. The major blip came in the second game when Bobby didn't show up at all in a big dispute over cameras and noises and conditions in the playing room. That's when despair mounted and we feared that the match would just end. The Soviets told Boris Spassky, you have been disrespected, the Soviet Union has been disrespected. You have every right to go home now and keep your world championship title because this American upstart is too rude. And Boris said, no, I want to play chess. He was a great sportsman.
Now, Fischer, and I have to say this is depicted really well in the documentary because there's this surviving television footage of this. He said he could hear the TV cameras. Anthony Sadie, do you believe him?
I think he had a heightened sense of hearing. Yes, I do believe that. I also believe that his ego was involved and he insisted on making everyone kowtow to his demands.
So the match gets moved into a quiet room in the back, and even though there's a huge purse here that I assume depends upon, you know, internationally televised transmission of this, the public really has to follow this through a chessboard. Is that right, Liz Garbus?
Yeah.
Where the moves are relayed to crowds and then the television doesn't actually see the players?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I mean, it was the most anticipated match. It had been anticipated for months and months, and everybody had followed the shenanigans of you know, would Bobby even show up? So Bobby shows up, you know, as you played in the clip, he's late for the first game. Spassky, the world champion, got to in game one, he plays white, so he played first, so he got to open, and you know, nobody was there. And then Bobby Fischer emerges, you know, comes into the room saying he was caught in traffic. And of course, it was just a blip, but at the same time, you know, it wasn't the way these things were usually played. For game two, the Icelanders had refused to remove the cameras from the hall originally, which Bobby wanted because Bobby didn't like the noise and he didn't like the cameraman, Chester Fox, who was had been given the contract to record the match and distribute it all over the world. So for game three, for the match to continue, the Russian team would have to agree that the match be moved into a different room. And so they end up, Spassky agrees, as Dr. Sadie pointed out. He did not need to agree. He could have just insisted that the match be played as per the plan. But he wanted to play Bobby Fischer. He wanted the match to continue. So he agreed to move this monumentally important chess match into the back, into a little ping pong room with, you know, just Bobby, Boris, the official, and a couple other guys. So all the people who had been anxiously awaiting this match were forced into this room, and they had to watch it through closed-circuit television and boards reporting the moves, calling out the moves. And so the whole arrangement kind of went south.
And Boris Spassky takes a 2-0 lead, which Anthony Sadie seemed like an insurmountable deficit to a lot of people at the time, right?
That's a huge lead in a match where the challenger actually has to win one more game than the champion in order to take the title. And this forfeiture of the second game, of course, was under protest. And I can't really fathom how many critical moments had to go the right way in order for this match to reach a conclusion.
Bobby Fischer committed a foolish blunder to lose one of the early games. And then he had this unorthodox strategy which allowed him to win game three, get back into it. People still talk about Game 6. Anthony Sadie, we don't understand chess like you do. What made Game 6 special?
Let's compare chess to music. And, of course, there are many varieties of music. Game 6, in a musical sense, would be Mozartian. It was a placid symphony of squeezing Boris Spassky's pieces to the point that they had hardly any moves left, and then the coup de grace at the end, sacrificing a rook for a knight. Everyone in the world thought that this was a magnificent game, and also it started with a move that Bobby had never, hardly ever played before, which was a surprise weapon. He kept springing these surprises on the Soviet side again and again and kept them off balance.
And how did Boris Spassky react to this Game 6?
The great sportsman that he was, he joined in the crowd's applause for the game, stood up and applauded his opponent. And Fischer, the humanity of that even got to Fischer.
The stories were that after Boris had, you know, stood up and applauded for Bobby at Game 6, Bobby said, you know, did you see that? Did you see that? You know, did you see what he did? He was moved. Bobby, who didn't really pay attention to other people's emotional displays, was really quite moved and satisfied at the end of Game 6.
Anthony Sadie, how did it end? How did the match end?
That was the turning point. Bobby seized the lead in Game 6, and he won going away. He lost only one more game out of the 21-game match. Totally dominated Boris Spassky. The chess world was surprised, very surprised, at the one-sided nature of the match. And it's clear to me that Boris was not himself, that all these disturbances and shenanigans at the beginning of the match had upset him. I don't think Fischer intended to upset him. He was just being himself. But we weren't going to protest the outcome. We were just thrilled that a lone American who had virtually no help had managed to defeat the world champion from the Soviet Union, who had all kinds of help that we never dreamt of in New York.
At age 29, Bobby Fischer achieves this historic victory. What kind of celebrity did this confer on him?
People said when he returned home to the United States, there was a sense that nobody was bigger, nobody was more important than Bobby Fischer right then. And when he got home, he got all sorts of offers to endorse products, but Bobby responded in his usual Bobby-ish way. For instance, Steinway Piano wanted to pay him several million dollars to pose for ads with their piano. And Bobby said, but that would be dishonest because that would give the impression that I play piano and I don't. So Bobby was, you know, sort of a bit of a naif in this world and certainly did not embrace it. Though when he did come back, he did appear on many talk shows, Bob Hope, Johnny Carson, Dick Cavett. And I think actually the most revealing moment in those months after the match was on the Johnny Carson show. When Carson asked Bobby, you know, Bobby, how did you feel when it was all over? You know, it must have been kind of a letdown, you know, after the match was all over. And Bobby said, yeah, you know, I kind of feel like something has been taken from me. And that really was a harbinger of what was to come later in Bobby Fischer's life. The great triumph was actually a loss of something for Bobby Fischer.
And he had gradually sort of retreated into isolation. Anthony Sadie, were you in touch with him during this period? Do you know what was going on in his head?
Yes, he became very close to the Worldwide Church of God, headquartered in Pasadena. And I never saw him unless he was transported by one of his church fellows, or I picked him up myself. He was in retreat. He turned down so many good offers. I personally was involved in one offer of $500,000 to make a record on how to play chess. And his reason for turning it down, I don't think any American in history has given a reason like this. He said, I could make a mistake, and 10 years from now, the Russians could find the mistake and badmouth me. Well, there was $500,000. You know, we don't make decisions like that, most of us.
Did you have concerns for his mental health then?
I had concerns, moderate concerns. I thought he was certainly capable of taking care of himself at all times, but he started to develop such deep resentments of classes of people. I can understand his resenting the Soviet Union, which had cheated and had perhaps delayed his ascendancy to the title. I could understand some of the things, but he became truly paranoid.
And you mentioned this church. Was it the United Church of God?
Worldwide Church of God.
Yeah. What were they about? Liz Garbus, did you look into them?
The Worldwide Church of God was a church where Bobby found sort of a home and a community, especially after 72, when he actually started living in an apartment that the church rented for him. They were a church with a very charismatic leader, Armstrong, and an apocalyptic vision. And when that particular apocalypse date did not come to pass, Bobby Fischer became disenchanted with the church and rejected them.
And, of course, he got interested in anti-Semitic ideologies. He read The Elders of Zion. Anthony said, did he recognize that he himself was ethnically Jewish? Did he?
He certainly considered himself Jewish when he was a kid. In fact, he told me one time, he said, those Irish kids, they don't like us Jewish kids at all. So there was no doubt he felt that he was Jewish.
So what do you make of his embracing anti-Semitism?
I think at a certain point, Bobby just rejected everything that he was, everything that he had come from. In addition to feeling angry at the Soviets for having cheated, and what Dr. Sadia was referring to there was that it was established that the Soviets would prearrange draws so that their better players could rise up in the ranks of tournaments without being exhausted by tough matches. And this was something that Bobby had complained about a lot. Some people called him paranoid about that at the time, but it turned out it was true. So Bobby was angry at the Soviets for this, but also Bobby also became very disenchanted with the U.S. As Harry Benson, one of the photographers who was with Bobby all throughout Reykjavik in 1972, said, there was never a fruit basket. Kissinger called him to tell him to go. But there wasn't support for Bobby once he got there. He was really on his own. And then, of course, later, the United States really pursued Bobby. So Bobby rejected Jews. He became an anti-Semite. And he also rejected America, applauding the events of 9/11 in one of his sort of most infamous speeches. So Bobby rejected everything that he had come from. And he even, stopped playing professional chess.
Anthony Sadie, what about the idea that when you look at what chess is, it's this infinite possibility of moves and a game in which you are thinking 20 moves down the road about how your opponent might get you? That's almost the definition of paranoia, isn't it?
You've got it. If somebody is scheming against you every minute, but most people are able to see reality and keep friendly relations with their opponents.
One of the other greatest chess players who ever lived is Garry Kasparov, who we interview for the film, and he is, remarkably sane, charming, and socially well-developed, so it's certainly not a rule. But yet, chess is a game which involves, constantly feeling like you are under attack, and indeed you are under attack from many places, anticipated and not anticipated. So it's a game, certainly, that heightens one's sense of paranoia.
Bobby Fischer was a recluse, it seems, or at least not often seen for 20 years. Then he reemerges in 1992. And does this spectacular rematch with Boris Spassky in war-torn Yugoslavia, violating a UN boycott, which gets him indicted in the United States, and kind of emerges as this angry crank. And I thought we'd listen to a piece of tape, and this is, I think, a call into a radio show after the 9/11 attacks in 2001, where he – well, maybe, Liz Garbus, is this where he is calling a radio show in the Philippines? Is that where this is from?
That's right. Bobby, through the 90s, would call in mostly in the Philippines to radio shows there and air his views, largely anti-Semitic and anti-American.
So let's listen. This is him calling into a radio show after the September 11th attacks.
This is all wonderful news. It's time for the U.S. to get their heads kicked in. It's time to finish off the U.S. once and for all. This just shows you that what goes around comes around, even for the United States.
And that's Bobby Fischer in 2001 reacting with glee to the September 11th attacks. That's from the documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World, directed by our guest Liz Garbus. Also with us, Anthony Sadie, an international chess master who knew Bobby Fischer. Liz Garbus, how do you describe his mental state in these last years?
I mean, it's a very, very sad story. I mean, we got into our possession tens of hours of Bobby's ranting on these radio shows. And it was really the rantings of a man who was not at all well and whom nobody was kind of steering back in the right direction without any kind of protective factors or supports. You know, the 9/11 comments are what they are. They're hateful. And we listened to many other hours of Bobby ranting this way. I listened for any clues. I kept on trying to sort of wade through them, find some truth, some introspection, and it really wasn't there. By the late 90s, it was really just a lot of ranting, paranoid ideas.
Yeah, he ends up being unable to return to the United States because he's under indictment, spends time in Japan. Finally, Iceland offers him citizenship, and he finishes his life there before he dies in 2008. And, you know, Liz Garbus, this interested me as someone, you know, who you study people and images. And when I looked at a lot of the film of Bobby Fischer when he was young and in his prime and playing chess competitively, when he was interviewed, he often seemed awkward. He looked away frequently, almost twitched at times, just did not seem comfortable. And those troubling scenes at the end where he's giving these angry rants, he seems at ease. He seems completely comfortable in his skin. Did that occur to you?
It absolutely did. I think it's a great observation. There was a part of him that was never that was always sort of fighting with himself to kind of, you know, be present in the media and all of those appearances. And then I guess the sort of floodgates were open and everything just kind of poured out. There was no censor. He was unhinged at that time.
He had romantic partners. I mean, there was a woman in Japan who I believe an Icelandic court concluded was his wife and was entitled to his estate. There was also a romantic partner in the Philippines, right? I assume you tried to reach these folks?
We did. We interviewed. There was a dispute after Bobby Fischer passed away. There was a dispute over his estate. A woman with whom he'd been involved in the Philippines claimed to be the mother of his child. Her name was Marilyn Young, and the child is Jinky. It's clear that she did have a relationship with Bobby and that Bobby was fond of this little girl. The little girl would come visit him in Iceland. They would walk around the streets. People saw them together. There were letters they had written back and forth. Ultimately, a DNA test proved that she was not Bobby's daughter. And Miyoko Watai, who is involved in the Japanese Chess Federation and also a friend of Bobby's, was found to be Bobby's legal wife. There continues to be a dispute over the estate. Bobby had two nephews. His sister Joan had two sons who claim they are the rightful heirs to the estate.
Liz Garbus, did you ever learn anything about his romantic relationships, how he related to women?
Yeah, we did learn about his romantic relationships. It seems that Bobby was not interested in women for conversation, for women as peers. Romantically, his relationship seemed to be somewhat stunted. From the Filipino woman, Marilyn Young, who we interviewed, they had a relationship. She didn't understand anything about chess. In fact, she barely spoke English, and so their relationship was not intellectually probably stimulating for Bobby. There were other women Bobby was involved with, a Hungarian woman named Zita Rexani, who also we spoke to over the phone, and her relationship with Bobby was very difficult, and he was not easy with women.
I think Zita made a cute remark when asked why she was friendly with Bobby. She said she had worked in a mental hospital and she had an understanding of this kind of person.
Hmm. You know, Anthony Sadie, this was somebody that you knew well when he was young and brilliant, and then you watched him from a distance as he deteriorated. Did you think of him much in those years when you weren't in touch?
I certainly did, and I intervened once in public and asked the world to leave him alone out of, quote, solicitude for the mentally ill. And somehow he found out about that, and he resented that quite a bit.
When people see the documentary, they'll see the images that go along with the voices that we've heard. But it's so striking when you see this kid, a 15-year-old kid on television, and how awkward and vulnerable he is. And then see Bobby Fischer in his old age as this contemptible anti-Semitic crank. I don't know. How do you regard him, Liz Garbus? Do you like the guy?
I have a lot of empathy for Bobby Fischer. One of the most surprising things for me in making the film was looking at all the footage of him, 71, 72. And he was, yes, he was awkward and nervous, but he had moments of real charisma and kind of inhabiting that rock star role that he was being given at the time. He could laugh at himself when an interviewer made him comfortable, like Dick Cavett made Bobby very comfortable. You know, he had a sense of humor and could laugh and be very, very charming. So, you know, yes, I like that man. And then later, you know, over the course of the years, and you listen to Bobby, I listen to all these hours of Bobby calling into the radio shows, you can't help but feel empathy. I mean, these ideas are not well-organized ideologies to commit violence against anybody. They're really just the ravings of somebody who has become unhinged and for whom there is really nobody sort of pulling him down and helping him. So, yes, I felt very empathetic to Bobby Fischer.
Well, Liz Garbus, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Anthony Sadie, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Filmmaker Liz Garbus and chess master Anthony Sadie. Garbus directed the documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World. Here's a scene near the end of the film when Fischer was living in Iceland, reflecting here on his life and talent.
I don't consider myself to be a genius at chess. I consider myself more to be a genius who just happens to play chess. You understand? So I could be doing any, I could have done and I can do any number of other things, you know? You know, I always wanted to write some songs. I was telling Evans, Larry Evans, this is back in the 60s, I remember. I said, you know, I listen to all these songs and I wish I could write that, but I try to write something, I try to think of something, and like, I just, nothing comes out. And he says, yeah, because you haven't lived. And I started thinking about it. He's right.
Bobby Fischer died in 2008. The documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World premieres Monday on HBO. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker on The New Yorker's first pop music critic, Ellen Willis. A new collection of her work has just been published. This is Fresh Air. Ellen Willis, who died in 2006, was part of the first generation of critics to take rock and pop music seriously and write about it with both erudition and passion. A feminist with a populist streak, Willis has often all but been forgotten in discussions of rock criticism until now. Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music, an anthology of her groundbreaking work, has just been published by the University of Minnesota Press. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Willis was one of the first rock critics at a time starting in the late 60s when serious writing about rock, pop, and R&B was rare. She was the first pop music critic for The New Yorker, starting in 1968. She combined a love of pop culture and an active engagement with feminist theory to create a unique body of writing, which finally gets a proper showcase in Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music, edited by her daughter, Nona Willis Aronowitz.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlors filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row.
The anthology leads off with a remarkable dissection a Bob Dylan circa 1967. Typical of this long piece, which appeared in a short-lived pop magazine called Cheetah, were assertions about her subject that no one had ventured before, yet which afterward became common wisdom. Quote, "His masks hidden by other masks, Dylan is the celebrity stalker's ultimate antagonist." To have seen this in Dylan in 1967, at a time when he was very much a public pop star, is typical of Willis's close listening to songs, adding everything she knew about the subject's public image and private life to arrive at a critical position. Willis loved stars from Dylan to Janis Joplin, but she also championed cult bands such as Joy of Cooking and the New York Dolls. Her judgments were never predictable. She argued that the Rolling Stones' diatribe Under My Thumb was less sexist than Cat Stevens' condescending Wild World because, quote, "Mick Jagger's fantasy of sweet revenge could easily be female as well as male." Writing with a directness and utter lack of fan gush, many of Willis's observations sound as fresh, as appropriate to the present music scene, as they did decades ago. Her 1971 criticism of pop music's tendency, both among the audience and the critic, toward, quote, "a tedious worship of technical proficiency," would be as appropriate now regarding TV shows such as American Idol and The Voice as it was in addressing music on vinyl back then. At a certain point, post-punk, around the time hip-hop became the dominant sound of popular music, Willis lost interest in rock criticism and pursued other interests. Feminist theory and activism, politics, and the philosophy of Wilhelm Reich, among many other topics. She'd become impatient with pop in part for its failure as an agent of social and political change, writing, quote, "There can't be a revolutionary culture until there's a revolution." She was the founder of New York University's Cultural Reporting and Criticism Program, and by many accounts, an inspirational teacher. Willis died in 2006 at age 64. Out of the vinyl deeps, whether she's writing about Elvis Presley or Moby Grape, resurrects a nearly lost, vital, invaluable voice.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on rock music. Join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.